You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
From Vineyard Theater in New York City, this is Theater Uncorked, where Vineyard artists come together to talk about the process of bringing new works to the stage. I'm your host, Eric Pargotch. For episode 6, we are joined by Jordan Harrison, Pulitzer Prize finalist for Marjorie Prime, in conversation with Obie Award-winning director Oliver Butler. After the success of his science fiction chamber drama, Marjorie Prime, Jordan wanted to dive into something totally different. That led him to the 14th century and the troupe of traveling actors trying to escape the Black Plague in The Amateurs, which received its world premiere at the Vineyard and was named a critic's pick by the New York Times, with Jesse Green calling the production a terrific, gutsy new comedy. A celebrated playwright, Jordan is the recipient of the Horton Foote Prize, Guggenheim and Hodder Fellowships, the Kesselring Prize, the Roe Green Award, the Heidemann Award, and an NEA TCG residency. He has written over a dozen plays, including Maple and Vine, Amazons and Their Men, Doris to Darlene, and the upcoming Log Cabin. He's also written for 3 seasons of the Netflix series Orange is the New Black and has developed television series for Sundance and TNT. At the helm of The Amateurs is Oliver Butler. Oliver is a co-artistic director of the Debate Society, where his recent credits include The Light Years, Jacuzzi, and Blood Play. He also directed the Lortel and Obie Award-winning The Open House and What the Constitution Means to Me. Regionally, he's directed at the Geffen Playhouse, Williamstown Theatre Festival, and Hartford Stage, and internationally at the Malt House in Australia. He is a Sundance Institute Fellow and a Bill Fuller Fellow. Both Oliver and Jordan made their Vineyard stage debuts with The Amateurs. We are excited the two could join us before the opening night of the play. And now, this is Jordan Harrison and Oliver Butler in Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard.
I think we started out as mutual fans. I shouldn't speak for Oliver, but I'll just say I started out a fan of the Debate Society, and I think I saw Cape Disappointment first, and I published the script in a journal of plays that I was co-editing at the time.
That's right.
I was really taken by... there were a lot of similarities with the things that I'm trying to accomplish. Like they tend to have sets that make sudden and aggressive gestures. There's a kind of sense in the Debate Society's work of traps kind of closing slowly around the audience. The revelation in Jacuzzi that these two affable backpackers are up to no good. There was a kind of quality of being like one step ahead of the audience that is a thing I find pleasurable, and that's how I first noticed Oliver Butler.
I think I first met Jordan possibly through my girlfriend Cynthia Flowers, who was introduced to me by Michael Cyril Creighton, who's in our production of The Amateurs, and Cynthia, because she had worked at Playwrights Horizons, had become familiar with Jordan's work. And I knew who Jordan was, and I had seen his plays. I'd read Doris to Darlene, and I saw, of course, Maple and Vine. I've been a fan of his for years. And I think the thing that, so we were in the same community, and we became friends maybe at the same time that we were sort of getting to know each other's work. And I'm a director who grew up backstage because my mother's an actor. And so I've always had a taste for plays that sort of deal in multiple layers of reality and consciousness. And I feel like Jordan has this like really incredible way of creating very playful worlds that are also sort of dramaturgically rigorous and very surprising. There's always sort of like multiple layers of story happening simultaneously. which makes them both sort of very fun and dramaturgically dense and beautiful.
We sort of became friends like at the same time as we became collaborators, but this is the first time we've gotten to do like a full-blown rehearsal experience. Yeah. We were kind of workshopping this up and down the country for 4 years, I would say.
Yeah.
It's been a long gestation period.
Yeah, yeah, that's yeah. right. Yeah, the trip out, God, that was 4 years ago. We went out to South Coast Rep, right? Mm-hmm. And we did a week-long workshop out there.
Yeah.
And that was, I mean, that was a really fun time. It was great to sort of jump all the way into this piece and to spend an entire week working on it with Heidi Schreck,
yeah,
who was in a few of the workshops of the play as well. Yeah.
We'll do a whole little section on Heidi. I could see your eyes like wondering, are we going to like pull the curtain aside and reveal the secrets?
Yeah, that's right.
No, I mean, it's funny because I really envisioned it. I set out to make it on purpose a kind of unwieldy, epic, three-act, you know, experience. And I think originally I imagined a couple intermissions that would be like grueling to go through physically, like Ariane Nushkin and now we have this like boiled down hour and 26 minutes of theater, you know, that still is somehow, I think, epic in its way.
No, I am amazed every time I watch it. And the fact that it is 126 minutes just baffles the mind for me.
Right. You go through so much.
You go through so much. There really is a lot of play and a lot of world and a lot of character in a very short amount of time.
A thing that Oliver brought to it that I love, that I'll highlight, is that so much of it is actor-operated. You have this kind of traveling pageant wagon of wonders that is the only source of color and fantasy in this kind of burned-out world. And so many of the things that it does are controlled by our actual troupe of actors. So in a way, you're seeing them become, there's this trompe-l'oeil effect of them becoming an actual team of traveling players.
Yeah, that was definitely something. I mean, we talked about that early on, and it was something that was very clear to me very early on, was that the actors needed to be the ones sort of operating the theater machinery. I do have to say, I said this already, my mother being an actor, I feel like I know some directors are really good at sort of exacting pain on their casts and sort of, you know, maybe not caring as much about sort of what they've got to go through. It became, you know, asking some of the greatest theater actors in our community to also do all of the theater machinery in the play. they were very game through the process, but there were, you know, there are times at which when you're asking these people to sort of actually drag the set around the stage back and forth, and what can be, you know, could be dangerous if not handled well, was something that it was great to have Jordan's support in doing that, because the two of us sitting there asking them to sort of do all that work makes it a lot easier and more fun.
Yeah, I mean, there are rehearsal processes where asking an actor to strike their own hat is in danger of overstepping. Like, just each process has its own boundaries, and they did escape some heavy lifting. I think originally we had imagined they would all like become experts on medieval instruments, and like it didn't become like a thing that there was, you know, really much real estate in the play for.
But that's right. And to their credit, they never actually said no to any of the big ideas. But yeah, when the ideas that were either untenable or unnecessary just sort of became revealed to us, we were allowed to, pull them back without any resistance from them.
I love the thought that because your mom was a noted theater actor, that's the sort of conscience sitting on your shoulder of like, what would an actor think about this?
I think about it a lot, actually, because I fancy myself as someone who understands the actor's world, but also wonders if I'm a little bit, in some ways gun shy about sort of pushing people in ways that make them uncomfortable in certain ways. Mm-hmm. So it's just how I frame myself. I'm sure I have no idea how I'm actually perceived in that. I might be one of the monsters, but I think I'm always like, too heavily invested in other people's feelings in the process.
Better than being
I guess so.
Emotionally dead, I suppose.
I guess
we should probably have mentioned that this is like opening night day. I could just hear it in our voices. We're still like in the middle of it. How do I analyze this thing?
I know.
This whitewater raft we're still on.
I know. It's opening is so weird. It's like for a director, I mean, I wonder if this is similar for you, but, you know, you're the most important person in the room for like 6 weeks, and then almost instantly you become sort of useless.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I go through, I think all directors go through some version of this, but you go through like this period of mourning.
Separation anxiety, right?
Yeah.
It's like go off to college, kids.
Yeah. And you really, I mean, you know, you go backstage or you give notes and you see the actors and they, you know, they receive the notes and they're happy to see you. But it is, you do feel profoundly useless. You're not useless, but it's a feeling that's sort of unlike anything else. What is it like for you when your play, after your play opens? Do you feel like your role shifts at all? Do you go through mourning after the process, or is it when the play closes?
I just sort of evaporate after the play opens, and it's not always by design. Like often I have somewhere I have to go back to, but it's like I like giving it away after opening. I don't feel anxious about that. Probably for me, the angst is the trickiest part is transitioning to tech, because that is when I should not have a voice for a little while. That's when the director is doing sort of their first draft. And and this process was unusual in that, like, the beginning of tech was one of the few times I could be there when we were in the theater. And Oliver was generous about, like, accepting the way that sort of accelerated some of the decisions, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm coming from a place where, with the Debate Society, Hannah and Paul are not only on stage, but I mean, they are heavily involved in the conversation around tech as well. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's funny, as a director, you don't actually see any other directors' processes. You know, you get to work with so many other directors, so you see how the different styles of people manifest. So for me, like, I have no idea what I'm looking at. Ann Kaufman's name behind you, and there's somewhere fun poster
hovering over my
shoulder. Yeah, yeah. But like, you work with other, you know, some of the most amazing directors in the field, and it just it occurs to me that, like, our process, while it may have seemed different, for we were forced, because I had you for 2 days in tech, so we had to sort of really make sure that we had the right vocabulary for the piece. That was sort of a normal process for me, because usually I have Hannah and Paul from the stage talking to me about ideas that we have and working things through.
You're a good director for a hands-on playwright, because you're used to them being collaborators in that way. I want to highlight, the first day of tech was the first day that the actors had to move this, like, monster cart through, like, a field of, you know, rubber mulch, which can't make it easier. And there was, like, it was just, you know, at first unwieldy and hard to make it turn so that it landed in exactly the right spot for the lighting. And there was a moment where Oliver went up on stage and moved this whole thing that usually four people move by himself. Like, he was this, like, ox, and it was like just a kind of on the subtext of it was that it was a demonstration for the cast that it wasn't going to be unworkable.
That's
and
right.
I just remember holding my breath, because the stakes of it were like, what if he can't move this thing? Then, you know, are we all going to mutiny, or, you know,
that's right,
flee to LA, or what are we going to do?
It felt nice when I got off the stage that Jordan seemed fully aware of what the sort of the metaphorical layers were to me going up there and doing that, because that is exactly what it felt like. Which,
thank goodness for CrossFit, right?
Yes,
all those tires made me be able to do that. You know,
that's right. That's right.
Annie Kaufman, because you brought her up, like, she says that all playwrights ask what other playwrights are like. All we want to know is that the other people are, like, more neurotic than we are. And when the truth, of course, is that we're all neurotic in our own our own way.
But I was on the phone with you. I was talking to Lauren, my assistant, about this, but I was on the phone with you during early previews, that right after you left, possibly. I forget. Anyway, I was on the phone with you, and then I got another call from Will Eno. And then at the same time, a text from Heidi Schreck. So I showed Lauren the phone, and I said, this is what a director's life is like.
It's a harem of need.
You're sort of managing, three layers deep.
Because we're on the Debate Society a little bit. I guess, how is it different to work with a playwright? Like, how is it different to work with me or Will Eno or Heidi after so many experiences with Paul and Hannah as co-authors?
I'd say the biggest thing, I mean, everyone's got their own special, you know, sort of approach to playmaking. And generally, if you're working with me, you probably have some sort of an interest in some sort of conversation about the development of the piece. Because I tend to, you know, in working with Hannah and Paul, I'm there from the very beginning. So like my voice is already a part of the sort of the writing of the piece. Mm-hmm. I would say the biggest thing is, and this, I don't, this is not a bad thing for me. I like this difference, but when you're working with a playwright, any of the playwrights I work with, they have already lived with the piece. Even though I started with this 4 years ago, you had already lived with it for at least a little bit of time. So you're sort of stepping into someone else's world. Mm-hmm. So there is sort of a layer of suggestion, or there's a level of suggestion that I don't give, or at least not for a while, because I'm still trying to sort of navigate what this sort of foreign world is. Whereas right. with Hannah and Paul, I'm like, I just say a lot more bad ideas because I know that, you know, they're able to be like, no, no, that's not right. Or maybe that's not right. It's just, it's a little bit more fluid.
Right.
You know? That's really the biggest difference, I think. Because, every playwright is completely, completely different, you know, in what their world is and what their process is.
Right. But I'm the least neurotic.
You're the least neurotic. You are the least neurotic.
I think since I turned 35, every play I've written has been about death in some sense, and probably this weirdly has a slightly more kind of jocular take on it, given you know, even though it's about the Black Death. I guess the starting point for me wasn't something as large as mortality. It was this finding hints of humanity before we were before people were quite as fully dimensional, and before the self was quite as large a construction as it is now. Looking at a 14th or 15th century painting and finding the person in it who's a self-portrait of the painter. In the case of the play, it was this character of Noah's wife in the morality play, Noah's Flood, who was just filled with more unknowable motives. The idea that, it's not logical for her to resist getting on the ark that will save her life, which God has told her to get on. So why does she do that? The writer Stephen Greenblatt writes that Shakespeare's main innovation was to add unknowable motives to these old stories. Like Romeo and Juliet was an old yarn by the time Shakespeare adapted it. But what he did was to make people not entirely knowable and lit with mathematically balanced motives. So, I'm way out in the weeds now.
I'm just thinking about, did you say unknowable motives?
Right. Why does Iago ruin everything?
Just love that as an idea of maybe that's sort of, Greenblatt must have just said that, but it's that seems like sort of an epiphany for me, the idea of something that's like a hallmark of sort of a modern character is the idea that things happen that we can't explain, which seems so obvious.
Well, a popular thing for a dramaturg or maybe an actor to ask is like, why would I do this? It's not consistent.
Yeah.
And so the thought of inconsistency being part of the spark of a human soul is interesting.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Ramp. Are you the decision maker in your company? Consider this. For the first time in decades, there's a better option for a corporate card and spend management platform. Meet Ramp, the only corporate card and spend management system designed to help you spend less money, so you can make more. Most corporate credit cards offer points as incentives, but those points amount to less than their worth in real cash value. Ramp's business cards offer you cash back, real money in your pocket. Plus, you control who spends what with each vendor. And Ramp's software collects and verifies receipts automatically, which means you'll stop wasteful spending and close your books in hours instead of days. Businesses that use Ramp add up to 5% to their bottom line the first year. If you're a decision maker, adding Ramp could be one of the best decisions you've ever made. And now get $250 when you join Ramp for free. Just go to ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy. ramp.com/easy.
Cards issued by Sutton Bank and Celtic Bank, members FDIC. Terms and conditions apply.
This is going to seem like a weird turn. How often do you think of death?
Oh,
not just your death or just think about like...
Yeah, I mean, I very rarely truly understand that I'm going to die someday, but I think every day, all the time, about the sort of passage of time and the way it feels like it's accelerating.
Mm-hmm.
And I do the math of, oh gosh, I last stood on this block when I was 22. That feels like yesterday, you know, and that's a kind of thinking about death, but it's not the same as, you know, will I get a burial plot? Will I?
Right,
it's
right.
Not the nitty gritty, perhaps. Yeah.
I mean, I think about death every single day a lot. It feels like almost all the time, like everything I look at and everything I do is in relation to like the last time I did that thing. And then every time someone passes, all I do is like the math between how old I am now and like how old they were, as if that matters. But I think about death a lot, and what you said about the fact that all your plays since 35 have been about somehow related to mortality. That wasn't what you said, but related to mortality. Mm-hmm. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, sure.
But the Debate Society is heavily involved in doing plays about aging and death. And most of the plays I've worked on have in some way, either because I see them through a lens of death and dying or mortality, or because that's just what they're about, have focused on that. And I think part of it, you know, has to do with also like, for some of us, when you get to your sort of mid to late 30s, I turn 40 next week.
People who are, you know, 60 are going to laugh at us talking about this. I'll just shout out to them.
But because our parents are that age.
Right.
You know, and my parents are both going through different, you know, versions of aging. I think about just what you said. My mother has Alzheimer's, and you know that. And she... watching what happened to her sense of self as things were removed from her consciousness, you know, things like numbers. Once numbers are gone, what happens to your sense of time?
Mm-hmm.
What happens when your sense of time is gone, and how that affects like your idea of what a day is?
Right.
And all of that kind of stuff has been just sort of going on very practically in my life as I watch someone sort of become less of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at this play, what I personally really found very sort of exciting and interesting on a very personal level was watching this idea of the evolution of the eye.
Right.
Being something that not just evolves for a single person as they become who they are, but that like through time our sense of I has somehow changed. And that actually made me feel very hopeful in reading the play and working on the play, because it gives me some idea that like, you know, what I think of as myself now actually has some evolution to go,
mm-hmm.
that there is some new sense of self that might be possible in the future. And I believe that
we'll get better at being human.
Yeah, exactly. And that feels so exciting to me, especially because I've watched it in reverse. I feel absolutely true that, or absolutely confident that, you know, that by, at, you know, if you can take away practical things from consciousness and diminish a person's humanness, well, then all you have to do is sort of like add things to consciousness that are helpful, and you will invariably increase their humanness.
Yeah. I mean, as much as we're talking about death, it feels like the business of rehearsal was almost more to do with like giving those players the will to live, you know, like the circumstance of the prologue is that one of their own just got taken by the bubonic plague. And so like so much of the work we were doing was finding, you know, the will to outrun it and pick up the wagon. And why would you put on this performance for the Duke? You know, that partly that's because that's the way that they end up broadening their idea of the self. It's like it's the effort to wake up every day on the cold ground and still go about the business of living.
That's right. Yeah.
I'm not someone whose plays change a ton in development, and this one changed more than most of them. I would say the great evolution of it since that first workshop 4 years ago was the character of Hollis and why she goes off script in the performance for the Duke late in the play. Mm. Like, I feel like the draft we were opening with at the Vineyard is much more clear about how she gets there. And it's not a direct road, but you see this person who's discontent with this play that requires nothing of her, and she starts to wonder what would happen if she didn't just say the lines as written.
Mm-hmm.
She goes through watching one of the other players suffer a stillbirth. She gets to the point where she has nothing left to lose, so why not bring all of herself into the play, onto the stage?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, part of that journey is the wonderful monologue written by Heidi Schreck. I should give a nod to that. I think now that people are listening to this after the play opens, we can mm-hmm. maybe reveal that surprise. So Heidi developed the role of Hollis with us in a few workshops. And then I asked her, there's this giant monologue by someone saying that they're Jordan Harrison, someone playing the playwright. And it started to feel like what was missing in the monologue was the actor's perspective. So I commissioned Heidi, who is, as illustrious a writer as she is an actor, I commissioned her with $300 and a winter hat to write about her experience. And now we're renegotiating the terms of that commission. It's about time. But so she responded with a monologue about playing Mrs. Cratchit in A Christmas Carol at Actors Theatre of Louisville earlier in her career. It felt like the right decision was to let Quincy deliver that experience as though it was her own, and I imagine that's what we'll do in subsequent productions, that the role will be named after whoever is playing it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right.
And then here at the Vineyard, and I should let Oliver chime in, a lot of the changes have been pragmatic and practical, but they impact the way the play flows in an important way. We cut the intermission maybe five previews in. So you're just like, it's just like a train that doesn't stop. And we changed the ending, which we should talk about because that's exciting times.
Yeah.
Like, I have actually not seen the latest version of the ending yet here on opening night day.
I will say I do have a certain amount of stress because Jordan, we had like a really wonderful, preview right before Jordan left about a week and a half ago. And then we've had rehearsals and we've had to do work remotely, on the end of the play. Yeah. I have like a little bit of stress around Jordan coming and seeing what is a basic, it's all there, but like edits that he hasn't actually seen in person.
Right.
For the first time.
The thing is alive, so it's like we have a good preview and I get on a plane and like it doesn't just kind of stay there. There were things that the show continued to need after I left. So we had a couple real detailed come to Jesus conversations and I sort of made some of the language in the final scene more accessible. And then we altered the very final moment in a way that I'm pretty excited about, even not having seen it,
I feel very good. I feel very confident about that. And the process, I would say, just while we're comparing you to to all the other writers in the world as well, in process, Jordan, I think, falls, there are writers who change nothing. And then there are writers who sort of change seemingly everything. I've sort of been a part of both of those processes. And Jordan falls pretty much in the middle of that. And I think that's a pretty healthy place to be because there's like so many forces like pulling at a play. And it's actually helpful to have a pretty solid anchor, so that you're not changing everything while you're working on something, so that you're forced to interpret what's actually there as best as you can. Jordan was really good about making changes when changes needed to happen and also sort of holding fast to what was there to help us fully understand what it was meant to be.
Sometimes you have to ask me three times, then I know
true.
This is unignorable.
Yeah, that's right. And the intermission, I mean, that's a big thing because I was pretty solid on the side of this play really was built with an intermission, which it was. When we first tried it, it was really like, okay, we'll try this, but we're ready to go back to the other thing.
Right.
And it really just felt, that was a big change. It felt very right. There's a few parts of having it that I think like there is an experience to having an intermission in the play that there are positive elements to that. I 100% believe this is the right choice. But it was that was an exciting thing to implement.
Yeah, it's like you say it was written for an intermission, but I would say, like, even more accurately, I had in mind two intermissions, and then
right.
It's just the third act was never quite long enough to justify that.
Yeah.
So in a way, no intermission mimics the structure of two intermissions a little better. Like,
yeah.
You were always supposed to experience the, I guess I would call it the contemporary act, the confessional act. Was always supposed to be a kind of parenthesis in between the two medieval acts.
Mm.
And when we cut the intermission, it actually, I think, helps it be legible in that way. So that's
agreed.
Why
yeah.
It's not just a, not just because we want to get people home, you know, in the nick of time. It's it's for art. And of course we got to discover this great sort of magic trick of Michael's costume transformation. Was very
rewarding. Really fun. I look forward to it every time I watch it. And then, yeah, and then the dirt. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like in our first meeting with David Zinn, he was like, we were just throwing around ideas. He's like, or, you know, we just like cover the whole stage in dirt. And, you know, it's like he showed us these photos.
Right.
Of,
it
like,
was sort of a throwaway idea almost, although maybe not for him. Maybe he like knew he was planting this thing in our heads.
Yeah.
You know?
I have a feeling he probably knows like the best way to get traction
right.
on an idea is to like. Just float it. But he showed us these photos, and you know, I mean, we were still in the it was just photos of some sort of art piece that was like rooms full of dirt, we were still at the place trying to understand sort of whether to just broad strokes, should the play's world exist in a, you know, a bright place or a dark place,
mm-hmm.
like, or just as you're sort of trying to figure out what a production is. For me, I sort of go back and forth between sort of extremes and whittle my way down to something
white box
very
or
specific.
Black box.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you even, weirdly, this relates to, you talked to me about characters having open eyes versus closed eyes.
Right. Big eyes and small eyes.
Big eyes and small eyes. Like
credo, yeah.
But I do actually enjoy sort of like broad initial choices. The idea of whittling things down is like a way that I've just often thought of my work, which is why it's like you have a lot of bad ideas until they're slowly become better and better and better.
Right.
So I think the dirt really was like, you know, Zinn recommended, you know, he was like a big pile of dirt. And I don't even know if we jumped on it immediately, but we started to then lean into the idea of a world of darkness that was then punctuated by a box of color, like that
right.
the theater and the people end up being this sort of colorful palette that is exploding out of a world of darkness.
Yes.
We just sort of like kept pushing at the idea and trying to take it further and further, and the dirt just sort of started to seem exciting.
We always liked the idea of them coming out of the darkness. Like, can you even see the back wall? And that's the way the physic is first revealed, just kind of like the rods and cones in your eyes can just barely make him out, and then he's there. And the field of dirt, like, really helps. They almost look like chess pieces up there. It's like the first way I heard it described. Like, it really makes each individual person pop. And I a thing that I'm grateful for about it is just the sheer simplicity of it, because the play has a lot of complicated demands, like a real dove, a fake dove, blood, a fire. And so to have something that isn't moving, you know, I mean, there's a certain amount of maintenance we learned even with a pile of dirt so that creepy crawlies don't start growing in it and so forth. But it is at least is an unmoving piece of the puzzle. A thing that's always been special to me about working with David Zinn on this is that my entire 15-year theater career, I never even met him, but he comes from the same small island in Puget Sound as I do. And we were both in the Grease Paint Repertory Company, like not at the same time, but I grew up hearing about David Zinn being this like the one out gay guy at the high school. And that was like, you know, 91, I was hearing about that. So the 80s, this was, and that was, whether I knew it or not at the time, like a kind of inspiration. He was one of the first gay people I knew about, and he had already made good designing things off Broadway. So it was in the monologue in Act Two, the playwright is talking about the kind of like little breadcrumbs that led him to an adult, self-actualized gay life, and David Zinn was one of those breadcrumbs for me. So it's a pretty cool thing for him to work on this.
Yeah, yeah. I you I feel like you must have told me about your connection to David, but I remember that I was interviewing him for the job and he told me, and I was sort of blown away. So either you told me and I like forgot it, but when he told me that, it sort of felt like one of those sort of like, because I've tried to work with David for years on projects and it just for schedule reasons that had never worked out. So the fact that we had this sort of overlap where he had actually gone to the same school as Jordan, that's it was just one of those sort of like cosmically connected experiences that I felt where I was like, oh, this is clearly the person who should be working on this play. He also gave a lot of recommendations over the course of the process. That were helpful, like even staging ideas and things that he sort of recommended over the process. So he's pretty good at seeding ideas in your mind and then making you think that they are your own. I will say, just back to Pile of Dirt, I got to say, like the vineyard sort of stuck with it. And actually, I credit Jordan and the Vineyard together for getting it to what it is right now, because we initially wanted like real dirt. But real dirt comes with a whole bunch of complications, including like that the act, you know, you're also balancing like what will the actors put up with for an entire run of a play?
The front row of the audience, for that matter.
Exactly.
Like breathing a bunch of
could be a total, you know, total mess. And they initially showed us all these different sort of rubber dirt products. And the first one they showed us like really wasn't going to look like dirt. And I think I was more just like, I think we can, like, we will imagine this to work. And Jordan was one who was like, this does not look right. You know, it's like it's crushed tires or something. And then, of course, somehow they like found these like three other products that were much more dirt-like that we ended up using. And then had to check to make sure they weren't carcinogenic. And like the Venn diagram that comes up with the thing we have on stage, which might be the only thing in the world that would work for us, like a black dirt-like substance that is not carcinogenic.
I just didn't want it to look like a playground, you know, and they accomplished that.
I probably would have relented much earlier, and Jordan was the one who was like, we got to keep pushing on this, and it came through. I have to say, we also, over the course of the process, I usually spend a lot more time on the stage showing people how to do stuff. I mean, I got up there to move the cart, but there was towards the end of the tech, I think Jordan and I were like, you know, we haven't gone up there because you got to put booties on. And I think it had actually created a little bit of fissure between us and the cast. Like the cast was sort of relegated to the stage and we were more relegated to the house, which is always the case. But Jordan was like, yeah, I think I'm going to go like lie down up there on a break a little bit, you know, just sort of break the barrier a little bit. Because you could sort of feel the sort of the tribes forming,
right?
You know,
it wasn't just for them. It wasn't just PR. It was also for me. I just felt like lonely and separate. I missed them, you know? So
that's
I
right.
like put on my little booties and like lay down on the pile of dismal rubber with the cast, and it instantly felt connected to them again.
That is also when I think of like, if I could go back in time and actually have some forethought on it, that's one of those like brilliant directing moves where like if you're trying to create a sense of isolation or a sense of disconnect or even create a little bit of maybe even hatred for the machine, the people in the dark telling you what to do. It's like you create a structural barrier like that.
Is that ever productive? Do you ever want to create a sense of isolation?
Well, I imagine. See, I also, just like I'm always imagining these other directors and how they work, I imagine there are the other better directors than me, like don't care about anybody's feelings, do these like amazing auteur things, even though they ruin people's lives, and also secretly manipulate these like structural things that like no one would know they were doing, that inadvertently infuse the play with something sort of hard to,
right,
you know. This is just
like
my
being a dick is out of fashion. I feel like maybe like a director 40 years ago, like there was a mystique about it.
Yeah.
And I don't probably.
Well, I feel like all our
some
teachers, and it was like my teachers and like my parents would like, my mother growing up in that time, they sort of worked in the theater, and I think in a much more combative time that like I don't think was good, but like, yeah, the way you heard great work was made was by somehow sort of like abusing each other in like sort of really sort of outrageous ways. And then you made it through the fire. But that does, I've never been like that. But I think I have some hangover from that propaganda that somehow like the greats, you know, the
strategically greats, lifted up one actor and lowered another because right, they suited the status or something.
Yeah. Which I just, I think it's a hangover from, I think it was propaganda that was like sort of infused in the, you know, from our previous generation that has never really felt right. But yeah, I still can't help but just believe they're, all the better people than me are doing that.
Or waging emotional warfare. That's funny. I just think of like the safer the better, you know. It's hard enough as it is.
Exactly.
I've been struck by, like, I don't want to like imagine what makes theaters not do plays, but there were a number of theaters that were pretty interested in the amateurs, and then I felt them being circumspect about the sheer scale of it. And I've just never felt like the Vineyard ever seemed deterred by that. Like, I don't even really remember hearing no as far as like a, you know, on the production scale. Like, we got our real doves, we got our snow, we got our fire. That there's a kind of scrappy fearlessness about this production team at the Vineyard and Sarah and Doug as well, that in a way it was the perfect place to put on like what would otherwise be like a scary and unwieldy thing. It's also special to me that it's Paul Vogel was my mentor at Brown, and so it's been special to me to be at her home theater for sure.
They've been a really great partner through all of this. I mean, when we, before we were actually in the building or rehearsing, you know, that you always feel sort of a sense of distance from a company that you're working with. It's more of like a theoretical construct, like, oh, you're doing a play there, but, you know, we're not going to like an office in the Vineyard and doing that. We're meeting people off site and preparing this thing. It's all very theoretical and distant. Once we were actually rehearsing, it was an immense amount of sort of handling and response. There's like,
They
get very hands-on. There's like a real team there supporting stuff. I mean, the whole dirt conversation, they really entertained. I have had other, you know, very complicated production processes where the theater or the people working at the theater give up much sooner. And no one gave up on us throughout the entire process, and never actually made us feel embarrassed or bad for asking for something huge. So it was a really well supported process.
I would say also even. Here's my little apologia to Sarah. Like, even after we like sort of solved the ending and the clouds went away and the sun came out, like, she still the next morning had like three specific line notes for me. You know, she didn't kind of wipe her hands and say, well, we figured out the ending and all's good. Yeah. Like, there was still like more that she wanted to take it even further.
That was
a great kind of relentlessness in a producer.
That's right.
Well, that's it for Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard. Thanks to Jordan Harrison and Oliver Butler for joining us on the podcast. Theater Uncorked is produced and edited by me, Eric Pargotch, Vineyard Theater's Director of Communications and New Media, with help from the Vineyard's Associate Producer, Ali Sky Bennett, and Marketing Director, Melissa Pelkey. Thanks to the Vineyard's Artistic Directors, Douglas Abel and Sarah Stern, and our Managing Director, Suzanne Appel, along with the entire Vineyard staff. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and rate and review us on iTunes. It helps spread the word. And last but not least, thanks to you for listening to Theater Uncorked at the Vineyard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.